from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He wrote songs that cut straight through the musical din. You heard them once and knew that, like it or not, you'd be singing that tune in the shower, hearing it everywhere. For a generation and more, composer Marvin Hamlisch wrote a huge piece of the American popular music soundtrack, the musical bed of dozens of shows and movies and millions of lives. He died this week at 68. This hour on Point, one singular sensation, Marvin Hamlisch. You can join the conversation from A Chorus Line to The Way We Were to The Sting and so much more. What made the popular music of Marvin Hamlisch hit home? What made it stick? What's your favorite? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York City is Maury Yeston, multiple Tony Award winning Broadway composer and lyricist. He wrote the music for Broadway's Titanic and Nine and many others. Distinguished musicologist, former director of undergraduate music studies at Yale, a great longtime friend of Ed Klaban, who collaborated with Marvin Hamlisch on A Chorus Line. Maury Yeston, welcome to On Point. It's so good of you to be with us today.
Hi, Tom.
You hear just a few bars of Marvin Hamlisch, and it all comes back. There's, of course, one from A Chorus Line. We could have dived in almost anywhere.
First note.
Yeah, first note, and you've kind first of note. Got it. What was it? I mean, we've heard a lot about him this week, and I'm still scratching my head and trying to figure out. You're inside this business. What was it about this guy who gave him such a handle on our musical ear, heart?
He is Marvin Hamlisch is the quintessential product of his musical generation. I think that's where you have to start. Mm-hmm. There'd never been a generation like it, because Marvin was born in 1944, and by the time he had come of age, which for him was seven, the LP had been invented.
Okay.
And once the LP had been invented, that meant that all during the 50s and the 60s, he could listen to every note of music that ever was. It all got recorded. This is a man who experienced in his lifetime, in real time, everything Beethoven, Brahms, Bartok, Stravinsky, Gershwin ever wrote, plus Shaboom,
right,
plus doo-wop, plus Elvis, plus the Everly Brothers, plus the Beatles, and folk rock, and the golden age of jazz, Miles Davis, Thelonious Monk, think about it, plus the golden age of movie scores.
Right.
And so he spoke that language. That's our world that we grew up with, the modern post-war era of music. Marvin Hamlisch was completely fluent in every one of those musical vernaculars, and he transformed all of them with his originality and his brilliance.
That is big. That helps me begin to understand. I mean, you're saying there had never been a generation that had been sort of technologically empowered. Just give them the LPs, let them listen to everything, and they've got that synthesis behind them.
That's right. And you know, I haven't even started the list. I mean, let's talk about world music. Miriam Makeba and Ravi Shankar and you know, all those foreign films that we, with all their great composers like Nino Rota.
So he grew up on a kind of super multivitamin of LP of the world.
He owned it, and we own it. That's the world we've become, and the language that we developed, the pop, rock, Broadway theater. It was the golden age of musical theater too when Marvin was growing up. Yeah. When he was a sophomore in college, he heard Fiddler. That's the date. He graduated college in 67.
Wow. And
you know, he grew up. He saw Rex and Julie in My Fair Lady. He saw Bobby Morse, in How to Succeed. This is his life, and because of that, it runs in his blood, and it runs in our blood, and that's the level of connection and comfort that we get every time we hear something that Marvin writes, because he's speaking our language. It's like listening to something from Pop 40 radio. It's listening to a new hit, which why he could write Top 40.
I think you're tapped right into it, and yet there were millions of people putting LP albums, on the record player at home.
Right.
And there were very few Marvin Hamlishes. I mean, here he is with, three Oscars and four Grammys and four Emmys and a Tony and three Golden Globe Awards. There was something special about how he could tap into all that and turn it.
Here's why. Because he was the complete songwriter, the complete composer, also the complete dramatist, a showman, an orchestrator, a teacher, a conductor. And on top of that, he became a personality. His name became fungible. He was there on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Yeah. And people would, you know, throw out a couple of letters of the alphabet and he'd play it on the piano and make a song out of it. And, you know, his music is filled with his personality. His music is filled with joy. It just makes us happy to hear it. It just gets to us. And great rhythm.
At Juilliard at 7 years of age, we'll talk about that. One of his very first early jobs, rehearsal pianist for Barbra Streisand, working on Funny Girl. Here he was, Marvin Hamlisch.
For Julie Stein, don't forget, for Julie Stein, who was the teacher.
Absolutely. Yeah. We'll look at all that here. Here he was, the man himself, Marvin Hamlisch, talking just last year. I mean, he died at 68, too young, but talking last year with the BBC about his process of songwriting, in this case, for The Way We Were.
It's also wonderful if you know who you're writing for. With The Way We Were, we were very lucky because we knew it was going to be Barbra Streisand. So if you're sitting at the piano, the first thing you do is you think about her notes and the fact that they're long. She does long notes. People, you know. So I start off with long notes. And then the other thing, of course, is we had a great title, a spectacular title. And so you make room for the title. And the way we were. So in a way, it's almost like a little bit of a formula here.
And here it is, 1973, Barbra Streisand, Marvin Hamlisch's The Way We Were.
Watercolor memories of the way we were.
The Way We Were won an Oscar for best score, best song. 1973's The Way We Were, Barbra Streisand, Robert Redford. I mean, Maury, that comes on, and if you're of a generation that lived through that, you're immediately sort of a prisoner of that, whether you like it or not. It just kind of took over.
It's even more than that. With that one song, Marvin Hamlisch joined the pantheon of the great American songwriters, and that one song entered, you know, the top list of the great American songbook.
But why? I mean, I read somewhere that Barbra Streisand at first didn't want to even sing it. It was too simple.
Yeah, and I heard that there was some talk about rewriting the bridge a couple of times. But you know what? I think that's the challenge of it. It's deceptively simple. What's great about that song is what's great about every truly great American song. There's no song. It sounds like no other song. It becomes the template by which you could say, hey, you know, there's a song that kind of reminds me of The Way We Were. But The Way We Were reminds you of no other song.
So how does Marvin Hamlisch dip into all those LPs, those sounds from the history and the world and Mozart and bebop?
What he does in each case, which is really quite extraordinary, is that he does something so deceptively radical you don't even know what it is. He will often start one of these truly great songs with a note from the scale that doesn't usually start. Most people you don't have to be a techie or a music theorist to know that, you know, a lot of music is built about the triad, you know.
Yep.
And there's the first, the third, and the fifth of the chord. Marvin will start a song on the sixth of the chord, which is where he starts The Way We Were.
And turns your head with that right away.
And then the minute he does that, he wakes you up, and you know when you're hearing something fresh. You know, Sondheim says when people leave a theater, they're not professional lyricists, but they know when they've heard fresh lyrics. And listeners, when they hear music, they know when they've heard something that's really fresh and really different and really catches their ear. And at the same time, the minute Marvin will do that, he'll bring you back into a tradition that makes you feel so comfortable that you don't even realize that you're hearing radical originality, and at the same time, it's completely enrapturing you. And that's his great genius.
Ladies and gentlemen, you want the formula for success. It's somewhere right in there, radical innovation and that touch for the traditional all at once. Let me ask you right here. I'm just reading in the LA Times here. You know, some critics would chalk up Hamlisch's appeal to a kitsch factor. The Way We Were, can't avoid it. I mean, it sweeps you away. It takes over the country, takes over the Billboard charts. You can't get it out of your ear, and yet that's in there. What is that?
Well, you know, I think whoever sort of relegated that to kitsch doesn't understand the meaning of kitsch.
I don't think it's relegation, but it's a piece. Yeah. It's a piece, isn't it?
It's not true. What it is it's frankly, it's a great melodic musical masterpiece that's written for one of the great virtuosos of the last century and this century. If you really want to talk about it, it's a great Verdi opera written for a Domingo. That's what's going on here in the popular context. And you know, I mean, let me tell you something. I knew the producer of My Fair Lady, Herman Levin, mm-hmm. brilliant man, and he used to say the public is no schmuck. And let me tell you something.
True that.
The public speaks on Marvin, and this is not some ditty. This is a really, what's great about Marvin is he's not simply a songwriter and a melodist. His compositional skill goes all the way down through the structure of the music. That's what's so beautiful about it.
But Maury, hold the thought right there, because we're going to hear a lot more, and I'm so glad to have the time and the music and you here to remember the great Marvin Hamlisch. Died too soon this week at 68, but what a record he left behind. This was his very first song by Leslie Gore. He was 21 years old, climbed the charts in the summer of 1965. Maybe not one of his greats, but you can hear the vigor in this man's composition right off the bat. Can you believe one guy wrote all this music? One man, Marvin Hamlisch, 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Watching Cisco pitter-pat, said I could do that, I could do that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Music Man, one singular sensation, Marvin Hamlisch, of a chorus line behind us right here with I Can Do That, of The Way We Were, of The Sting, the popular soundtrack of an American era. Composer dead this week at 68. You can join us this hour. Can you believe one man wrote all this music? Have you been astonished as the tributes rolled out this week? You know, what? He wrote that and that? Boomers, was this not the emotional soundtrack of your time? Maybe a little small sometimes, but irresistible, a popular force. What made Marvin Hamlisch's music irresistible? What made it conquer? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Maury Yeston is with us, multiple Tony Award-winning Broadway composer and lyricist. And Maury, you know a lot about this. I mean, you were great buddies with the lyricist for A Chorus Line.
Oh, sure.
Right in the middle of it. Tell us about how this whole thing came to be.
Well, you know, I can speak very authoritatively on this. Ed Kleban and I and Alan Menken were early members of the BMI Music Theater Workshop in the early 70s, and this was Ed's first job. He got the job from Michael Bennett to write the lyrics with Michael Bennett's favorite dance music arranger. And that's very important, because what you were just listening to, mm-hmm. and I Can Do That, was brilliant dance music.
And tapping right there, we hear it.
And if you listen to one fabulous sensation, what you're hearing is the music is actually functioning almost like a tap dance in itself. And mm-hmm. Ed made a deal with Marvin that every new thing they wrote, he'd like to play for our workshop. So I actually was the first person to hear all these songs as they were writing them. And they were so thrilling and so radical. Let's talk about how appealing they are. A song like One, mm-hmm. fabulous
singular
sensation. You know,
sensation.
Everybody recognizes that vamp. There are two great vamps that I think, two greatest vamps of the last half of the 20th century were New York, New York, and One.
Now, when you say vamp, what do you mean?
Vamp is the little musical prelude, rhythmic musical prelude that introduces the song. Mm-hmm. For example, New York, New York goes da 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 da. Right, everybody knows it. Or
everybody.
One goes da da ba da da. Well, they have something in common. They both are the first notes of the song. Da 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 da. Start telling the
right.
And one fabulous and say the sen one. singular sensation becomes dot, 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 dot.
Yeah, so, it's right there, planted.
So it's, I hate to sound like a sort of a kind of a fuddy-duddy musicologist, but that's exactly the kind of thing that a terrific composer will do instinctually. They don't really think about this, mm-hmm. but that's what gives the music such a wonderful unity, integrity, and pizzazz. Second thing one does is, how many songs do we know that start with one note and then wait? One, two, three. Yeah. Well, I can think of two more. You're driving me crazy. And, another one is Kids. I don't know the matter. Both of those songs are great, great tap numbers. They're great dance numbers.
And it puts you right in that dance mode because you can see the dancer making the move, waiting for the next move.
That's exactly right. And that brings you to why we have this music in the first place. Because, we like to say the greatest invention of American culture is jazz. But the truth is, it widens. The greatest invention of American culture is the Great American Songbook written by European-influenced songwriters who were completely captivated by syncopated melody. It's that combination of African-American rhythm.
Yep.
And so it's no secret that Marvin Hamlisch would have kicked off the ragtime revival by picking up on Scott Joplin and that thrilling syncopation innovation that he brought into the sting.
Absolutely. We'll come to that. I want to stick with this one for just a minute. Here he was synthesizing all this Viennese heritage, Jewish parents there in New York. You've got a whole thing going on. I want to talk about that angle as well. But you knew Kleban, Ed Kleban, the lyricist here, so well. What about the interaction? How did it work? Which came first, music, lyrics? How do they roll together with Marvin?
Well, I think Marvin very often came up with the tune, but Ed had don't forget, Ed was also a composer, mm-hmm. and I think that they interacted very well. One of the things that Ed brought to the table, and you can hear this in the opening number of A Chorus Line, and you can certainly hear it in one, Ed loved to write countermelody, and I think he influenced Marvin so that countermelody means that while some people are singing one thing on the stage, simultaneously, somebody else is singing something else that works beautifully against it.
Yeah.
And I know Judith Klerman is going to be calling in pretty soon, and she's a choral music expert. But you see, what you get there is you get the next level of innovation in musical theater where somebody can be singing, and at the same time, you can be hearing what they're thinking while they're singing.
Let's hear a little more of that, Maury. We've got At the Ballet here, of course, of Marvin Hamlisch and lyricist, your friend, Edward Kleban, collaborating with the actors in the process of writing, listening to their life stories, setting them to words and music. Here we go, At the Ballet.
Mother always said I'd be very attractive when I grew up. Different, she said, with a special something and a very, very personal. I hated her.
Storytelling really going on. This is almost oral history, Maury.
Exactly right. And don't forget, you're listening to Syncopation. You're about to go to Ravel.
One was different, who couldn't figure that out. So beautiful.
Let's go to Nancy in Lexington, Massachusetts. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to share the memory of how I first came to know Marvin Hamlisch and his music, and it was way back when I was a college sophomore.
Okay.
My roommate went to see A Chorus Line on some sort of break. She bought the album, and we didn't have a record player in our little dorm room.
Yeah.
And the way I came to A Chorus Line was she sang all the songs to me at night as each of us were lying in our bunk beds in our dorm, and she could sing, and that's how I came to know A Chorus Line, from her being so impressed with it, and then her singing it impressed me with so much.
So you welcome. You weren't throwing your pillow up to the top bunk, Nancy. You were rolling with it.
No, I sat there and enjoyed it, but it was just the weirdest thing that we would go to our bunk beds at night,
yeah.
and then Donna would sing me every number from the show.
Well, they had that quality. People singing them in the shower, humming them all day, whether they liked it or not. And the Ravel, is that Everything is Beautiful at the Ballet?
Everything is Beautiful at the Ballet, yeah.
Well, now, what do you mean when you say that's Ravel? Sorry, Maury.
Well, because suddenly it becomes a waltz, mm-hmm. and suddenly it becomes this sort of vaguely, wonderfully impressionistic, atmospheric piece of music, completely different from this introduction, which is jazz-oriented, which is tap, or which is dance-oriented. And Marvin was able to make all of these all of these different styles of music, chapters from his chosen musical Bible. And they would become the language that Marvin Hamlisch could speak or could write so easily. He could go from that to the delicate restraint of a mm-hmm. of the underscoring of Sophie's Choice, or to a James Bond pop tune. He had all of it, and he used all of it whenever it was appropriate. I think that's the great thing about him. He was just a master craftsman as well as a great personality.
Pulling off that palette when it was just right to pull. Joey in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Joey, you're on the air with Maury Yeston.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Real great subject today. It's also the anniversary of Jerry Garcia's passing as well.
Okay.
The thing is that I put on Facebook yesterday, Marvin Hamlisch was musical genius, departed. He's an inspiration to songwriters in all genres. I'm a rock and roll kind of guy, always have been, always will be. Like writing all kinds of music, certainly not show music, but I feel the appeal.
No kidding. You can't miss it. I mean, you and how many millions more, Joey, but I appreciate your call. I want to, if I may, Joey, thank you very much. And Maury, stand by there. You mentioned Judith Klerman. She joins us right now from New York. Collaborator of Marvin Hamlisch, award-winning music director, conductor of Essential Voices USA. It's a New York-based chorus in residence with the New York Pops at Carnegie Hall. Collaborator, friend of Marvin Hamlisch. She's conducting the recording for Hamlisch's upcoming children's book, Marvin Makes Music. She's also arranging and conducting choral selections of Marvin Hamlisch's music for his memorial service on Tuesday. Judith Klerman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi. We're sorry. We know Marvin was a friend of yours, and you know, it's funny. There is, of course, a spirit of celebration in looking back on his life, but at the same time, we know it's painful, and we're sorry for the loss, Judith.
Thank you so much.
I can't help
remembering some wonderful moments.
Well, tell us what it was like working with him.
Well, briefly, I always believed in him, and I first brought him to Lincoln Center when I music directed the Lincoln Center tree lighting, and I had a cast of the Muppets and kids, and he came and he played his song, one song, and I had hundreds of kids singing for him,
mm-hmm.
and I was conducting them. We just had a great time. Next, I organized a bunch of kids for his performance of Anatomy, a piece, a classical composition, a Carnegie Hall performance. We had a great time as well, and I was thinking about it last night. Then we became friends. Then we started eating out. Then we started talking about music. Then he invited me over to his house, and I looked at all of these awards. And I remember the first time going into his home, and it was truly like an American musical history museum. And every picture and object had a story.
I mean, it's just incredible. When you look at these just piles and piles of movie scores here, you know, The Way We Were, but Bananas and Ordinary People and Sophie's Choice, Maury mentioned, and Three Men and a Baby, Little Nikita, Frankie, and Johnny.
He was at the Golden Globes with The Informant.
The Informant with Matt Damon just in 2009, so the day before yesterday.
That's true. But I also knew there was another side to Marvin. And when I directed choral activities at the Juilliard School, and Juilliard was celebrating its 100th anniversary, I asked him to write a serious piece.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. And it's really one of the hardest pieces of choral music ever written for piano and flute and chorus, based on an Emerson poem called Music that he wanted to set since he went to Queens College as a young kid.
Judith, Maury points to the LP record album as, you know, he was of the generation that could and did listen to everything, and there's a great source for what made his music so compelling. He'd draw and synthesize. How do you see? What made him such a, just a, you know, he kind of conquered continents of the culture with his music. Why? What was it about his way?
I often describe him this way to somebody. Like, he was a kid with a box of Crayola crayons and not five crayons, but one of these big boxes of, like, 87 crayons.
Mm-hmm.
And Maury just said that he talked about Marvin's musical Bible, I'll talk to you and say that he had a box of crayons and he had all different colors. He might not have gone and played in the concert hall and played Bach and Beethoven, but he knew all of that stuff.
Yeah, but he could go in so many...
He knew every pop tune, and he knew every rock tune, and...
And the whole fake book. A thousand American songs.
Wow.
By heart.
Yeah. Wow, by heart, and he could go in so many directions off that. Here was, he wrote, Nobody Does It Better. This is for Carly Simon to sing over the titles of the 1977 James Bond film, The Spy Who Loved Me. The song became a big hit on its own, nominated for an Academy Award.
And nobody does it better. Though sometimes I wish someone could. Nobody does it quite the way you do. Why'd you have to be so good?
Bach, Beethoven, and Carly Simon climbing the charts with Marvin Hamlisch there. Matt in Newcastle, Pennsylvania. Matt, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, what do you know?
Well, you know, Marvin Hamlisch would bring the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra up to our community about 50 miles north of Pittsburgh, small community, about 28,000 people. And he performed about a half dozen times, and it was just a privilege to be able to listen to him. He was so entertaining. And
now,
so
was he
great.
Conducting the Pittsburgh Pops or playing the piano or both or what, Matt?
He would do both. He would conduct the Pittsburgh Pops. He would play the piano. He was entertaining. It really gave me and many people in our community the impression that Marvin Hamlisch wanted to bring a little culture to the community. He felt as though, you know, we're in an area where the old steel mills have decayed and the economy has declined, and he just felt, I think, that Newcastle needed a lift, and he did everything he could a half dozen times over the last 8 years to do that, and we are very grateful in our community to have Marvin Hamlisch there, and it made a difference for a lot of people.
A lift from Martin Hamlisch for your town and many, many others. And people, Matt, I appreciate that. Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Julie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, Marvin Hamlisch was the conductor of the Milwaukee Symphony Pops Orchestra, and I was fortunate to see his concert last year where he was conducting Marvin Hamlisch. He was so engaging with the audience, so funny and charming. He kept chatting with a four-year-old child who was sitting in the front row, asking her throughout the show what she thought of his music. I just considered his work to be part of the soundtrack of my life. I'm a boomer.
Mm-hmm.
Grew up learning to play his songs on the piano. And I also want to mention another little story that I thought was kind of telling about the kind of person he was. A few years ago, I was in Indianapolis to attend a wedding and stopped at a Walgreens just to get a toothbrush, and there was a giant black limo parked outside. I go in, and there, standing in the cold medicine aisle, is Marvin Hamlisch. I couldn't believe it. He had stopped at the store to pick up throat lozenges, and he was in town for a concert with the Indianapolis Symphony. So it was thrilling to see him in the Walgreens and also on the stage with the Milwaukee Symphony.
You've got the whole range, Julie. Thank you so much for that image, the limo outside of Walgreens. Everybody has to get some cold medicine once in a while. Judith Clearman, give us some sense of what the music will be at the memorial service for Marvin next week.
Well, I'll be working with a chorus, I hope, of between 400 and 600 people. We're assembling that right now. And we'll perform The Way We Were. What else will we... I'm sorry. The Way We Were, What I Did for Love, and At the Ballet.
Wow.
They'll be done simply and just with piano. And Marvin's collaborator and my collaborator... on projects, Larry Hockman will be playing for the chorus.
We will be thinking of that moment, all the people there, and of course we can help thinking of that music. Judith Clearman, award-winning music director, conductor of Essential Voices USA, longtime collaborator of Marvin Hamlisch. She is putting together the choral selections for his memorial service next Tuesday. Judith Clearman in New York, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Maury Yeston in New York, it is great to have you. There's so much more we want to think about, learn about. 800-423-8255. We're remembering Marvin Hamlisch. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Brooke, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great popular composer Marvin Hamlisch, The Chorus Line, The Way We Were, and so much more, so much. Behind us here, a selection from Hamlisch's score to the 2009 Steven Soderbergh film, The Informant, starring Matt Damon. Way back in the 60s, he began to make a big imprint on the popular culture, and he just kept at it. Died this week at 68 in Los Angeles. Maury Yeston is with us this hour from New York, multiple Tony Award-winning Broadway composer and lyricist in his own right. A lot of questions here. What do you think? Does a popular music master capture something in the culture, or does he create the culture? Was it Marvin Hamlisch's world and we just live in it? And who's today's Hamlisch? Is there one? Do we have him anymore? Is it Jay-Z? Is it Lady Gaga? Ooh. 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Let's get a call, Maury, if I may, from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Peter's calling. Peter, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
One thing that was being touched on was his Juilliard experience, but one thing is in his film scoring is the incredible orchestral skill that he had. And I was thinking of a film from 1968 called The Swimmer, which was one of Burt Lancaster's best films, and it just sort of came and went. But his music is orchestral, rich, utterly full, and could grace a concert hall with ease. And for my money, it's just one of the best film scores ever written. And then, of course, his musicality in terms of the musical world is pretty well, as you have indicated, unparalleled. But I urge people to order a CD of The Swimmer and just have an experience they won't forget.
Peter, I'm so glad you raise it. Maury, I mean, speak to the orchestral scoring.
Peter, you're completely right. Mm-hmm. And one of the great things about Marvin is that he knew the function, and he knew the place of the film underscoring, which is not to dominate. Marvin was not the kind of guy who would come in with Lara's theme that was going to dominate the movie. It was going to serve the purpose. And I agree with you. I think his score to The Swimmer is masterful, not only for its musicality, but it's for its orchestration. That little bit we were just listening to from The Informant. You know, Marvin and I were at the Golden Globes together. We had both nominated in the same year. And what you heard there was this quintessential, beautiful American jazz orchestration. Reminded me of a little bit of the Stan Kenton Orchestra, a little bit of Miles Davis, something that was going to underlie exactly the mood and the ambiance of the movie. Think about a movie like Sophie's Choice and the subject matter of that movie and the delicacy and the restraint. If you listen, you'll hear how Marvin uses the flute, how he uses the harp, how he holds himself back in a way that almost as if that the music is hiding something, as Sophie was hiding something. He's just a master musical dramatist, and I think he's underappreciated for that, and I think as time goes by, he'll be far more appreciated for
that. We have something from that right here. And Peter, thank you so much for your call. Here's from the 1982 film Sophie's Choice, Marvin Hamlisch's love theme. Beautiful and just as haunted and beautiful as the film. Ellen in Baltimore. Thanks for calling, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a member of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, and Marvin Hamlisch was our top conductor for a lot of time in the 90s. And he was very friendly with a lot of musicians and had some on-stage banter with me that he kind of felt, well, maybe I'm a little sensitive about that. And I wasn't, but he felt bad about it. So the next night of our performance, he called me into the dressing room. I thought, oh, my God, what's wrong?
Now what? Yeah.
And he presented me with a wristwatch that he had purchased for me because he felt, I felt bad about this, It was the previous night was my birthday, and he had made fun of some present my husband had given me on stage. Well, he was offended by this. And I wasn't, but he said, here, I don't know what your taste is, but I feel really bad. So, here, take this. And I always said, like if St. Marvin Hagwitz gave me the time of day.
That's a little onstage banter, fun at your expense, and then a gift to make sure everything was all right. What about him as a conductor, Ellen?
He was a very very good conductor. He was obviously much more of a composer, but he was a fantastic performer. His relationship with the orchestra was fantastic. Our audience absolutely loved him. He had the stitches most of the time.
Ellen, we're losing you a little bit, but I'm so glad for that story, especially from a violinist from the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. I appreciate your sharing that. If I may, Maury, let me get one from Nashville here. Dan, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Several things about Marvin Hamlisch. Number one, I was so sad. My wife and I wanted to hear him play this year in Nashville at the Skirmerhorn Symphony Center, and he became ill, and we weren't able to hear him. And I was so upset about that because I'm a fan of his for a long time. Particularly, I enjoyed what he did with Scott Joplin's music in the movie The Sting.
Sure.
I'm sure you remember that, and that he received an award for that. The memory that I mentioned to your screener may be incorrect, but As I remember it, Barbra Streisand was making the award, and she smiled as she was pronouncing his name, Marvin Hamlisch. Did that really happen? Was that right?
Yeah, it seems, I don't know, it seems unlikely. I mean, she'd known him forever and a day. The relationship between Barbra Streisand and Marvin goes way back, Maury.
Well, whether she did or whether she didn't, I think everything that we've been hearing from Judith and from people all over the country is the thing that really needs to be said, which was this was the most unpretentious, humble, ordinary, wonderful guy. He never thought he was special. He was so deeply generous to people. He cared so much about music education. That's why he went to Pittsburgh and he went to schools. He was just the most wonderfully humane, warm, generous human being, and I think that comes out in his music.
You can't help but feel it. I don't know how you could make that music if you didn't somehow have that deeply within yourself. I guess he must have. Dan in Nashville raises Scott Joplin's music, and it's so interesting the way he sort of resurrected Scott Joplin and maybe made him in some ways bigger than he'd ever been. Let's listen to that and think about it for a minute. Of course, just as famous as it could be, the score for 1973's The Sting with Paul Newman and Robert Redford won an Oscar for that. Let's listen. The Entertainer from The Sting. Now, Maury, here you've got Scott Joplin, turn of the century, something?
Turn of the century. Yep.
And Marvin Hamlisch brings him back in a way, makes him bigger than ever. But what did he do with this music, and how does it count to a composer when he's really arranging and reintroducing, music that's decades and decades old?
Well, the first thing you have to remember is that Scott Joplin is really the progenitor of this music.
Yes.
He took it from plantation music, and he really created ragtime. This was basically piano music that Scott Joplin wrote. He thought it was classical American music. He printed it out to be played like serious piano compositions, and he wrote a ragtime opera called Three Manisha. And interestingly enough, when Irving Berlin wrote his ragtime, that was sort of 1917. That was sort of the end of the period, and it was completely resuscitated by Marvin, who just felt in his musical knowledge that this was exactly the arcane, funny, ironic spirit that would match these con men. who would be sort of going back to that sort of earlier innocent time. And the brilliance of what Marvin did was the orchestral treatment. You hear that high piccolo reminding you of Sousa marches from 100 years ago.
Sure, sure.
And he just, and you know, this generation is so anxious to listen to new things and novel sounds. It's why we loved George Harrison when he brought the sitar into pop music.
Mm-hmm.
And Marvin just brings this music into our century. I think that's the reason. I mean, that's the reason, you know, we have a show called Ragtime. That's the reason one of the great musical composers still living with us, Bill Bulkham, wrote so many ragtimes that he finally wrote one called Last Rag because he had to stop. And then he wrote another one after that, apparently.
You know, I have the sense of the country, in a way, almost feeling gratitude when a composer like Marvin brings back this history, makes it so vivid again, and suddenly our life is richer in the moment with its felt roots to that time and that cultural heritage.
That's right. This is our history. This is our culture. That's where African-American music joined with European music and made our wonderful American music that's now become the vernacular of popular music of the whole world. And Marvin is so structurally important to that as a historical figure, as an inspiration. You know, the contributions of this man to American music and American musical history is just almost impossible to measure.
Let's just get more flavor here. The Goodbye from the Goodbye Girl, No More. This is collaborated with Neil Simon on the 1992 musical. It was based on the 1977 film of the same name. Mixed reviews, but here's Broadway star Bernadette Peters singing No More, in which her character, Paula, swears off men.
In my experience with men, I've spent a lifetime proving you know a man is lying when you see his lips start moving. My woman's intuition ought to be recalled or overhauled. Most men have backbones like a strand of all the cuck linguine. Just say commitment.
Michelle in Newton, Massachusetts. Michelle, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just had a funny little anecdote. Years ago, I was the house manager at Mechanics Hall in Worcester, and I had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Hamlisch when he performed there. I think it was 1990. And they came in the afternoon to load in and get set up and do their sound check, and then Marvin came up to me and asked me, he said, he wanted to know if there was a Friendly's restaurant in the area. And I said, well, sure. And he said, could you tell my driver how to get there? And I said, sure. So I told him to give the driver the closest directions to Friendly's. And later on, the promoter of the came up, and they said, where's Mr. Hamlisch and his entourage? And I said, oh, they went out for lunch.
For a burger.
He was furious because the El Morocco, which was, you know, the place in Worcester at the time, they had photos of all the performers, and, you know, on the walls, and the El Morocco was expecting Mr. Hamlisch for
right.
lunch, and they were quite upset.
He's down at the Yeoman's Restaurant down at Friendly's. I love it. Thank you for that, Michelle. Let me get one more from New York, Hamburg, New York. Marley's calling. Marley, you're on.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
Very well.
Good. Tom, I'm a jazz singer in Western New York. And I performed at the Inn on the Lake in Hamburg, New York. And I sang all the Marvin Hamlisch songs, the big production ones.
Sure, great.
One, What I Did for Love. I loved him dearly. And at that time, in 1974, I was dating Mitch Miller.
Okay, this is the conductor, producer, sort of helped invent the modern pop record.
Yeah. And he and Marvin and I and a whole bunch, we were at cocktail parties together. And what a joyous person he was. And I enjoyed singing his music galore. And my audience loved it also.
So
all I can say is God bless him wherever he's at. He's in a wonderful place. And thank you, Tom.
Oh, happy to do it, Marley, and thanks for your singing, a singer's testimony there. Here's For Susan from The Sweet Smell of Success. This was a 2002 musical based on a 1957 film.
Susie, get the box. Look at this stuff, Sydney. Sheet music signed by Berlin and by Kern for Susan. Bogey sends buckets of love from Lucerne for Susan.
John Lithgow singing there. One more call. Here's David, Chesapeake, Virginia. David, you're on the air. Hello, David, are you there, my friend? Oh, you may have lost him. Well, let me ask it then, Maury. I mean, where does it go? Who takes on this kind of baton of building the popular music bed for our national life?
The future. I have to tell you, I've been teaching the BMI Music Theater Workshop for over 25 years, and there are such brilliant writers now, and right now we're in this great postmodern era, an internet era where, you know, you can download or you can get to any music at any time, and the young writers today are thrilling, and there's just no end to it. What's great about this form of American musical theater, American popular song, jazz, film scoring, is that it's the growing green shoot of American culture that keeps on growing and keeps on evolving and developing. It's a living, active, developing form.
Is that where we still get our kind of national soundtrack? Or has it moved? I mean, is it I don't know, Kanye West or Jay-Z or somebody else?
It's,
or is it, still it is.
It's rap. It's rap. You know, ragtime has become early jazz, has become 30s jazz, has become bebop, has become cool jazz, has become jazz fusion, has become rap. And tomorrow it'll be something else. It's this irrepressible combination of the American melting pot of musical styles from all over the world that have come here and created this dominant vernacular, of which Marvin is such a great contributor. And it will not end. It will not end because there are people right now in Japan writing original musicals influenced by Marvin Hamlisch. It's become a world phenomenon. And we have such a great future to look forward to. There will be other Marvin Hamlisches. No one has ever complained that there's too much good music in the world. And there will continue to be.
Well, we are built to love it. And he knew just how to deliver it in a way that made it really stick. Maury Yeston, Tony Award-winning Broadway composer and lyricist of Broadway's Titanic and Nine and much more. You've been so generous with your time and insights today, Maury, and we're very grateful for it.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Terrific to have you, as we remember the great Marvin Hamlisch. Go out with What I Did for Love from 1975's A Chorus Line, sung here by Priscilla Lopez and the rest of the cast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.